Robert Green with us, The Laws of Human Nature. I want to talk with him about one of his other books called The 33 Strategies of War as well. And we're going to take your calls this hour when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Robert Green with us, and your phone calls this hour here on Coast to Coast, so make sure you're part of the show. Robert, in one of your books about war, of course, The 33 Strategies of War, you define some fascinating aspects of war. Why are we, by the way, such a warring species?
Well, you know, it's interesting because they used to think that the theory was that our hunter-gatherer ancestors were basically these peaceful kind of creatures, you know, kind of the myth of the happy savage sort of thing, and that war basically started when civilization began and people were crowded into cities and there were fights over territory somewhere beginning maybe around 10,000 years ago. But in fact, research by people like Jared Diamond and other anthropologists have shown that it's actually a much more complicated picture, that there were skirmishes and battles well before we kind of settled into towns and cities and settlements. And that so when you look at it that way, you see that war is, and kind of our aggressive impulses and our fighting over land and resources has a history that goes way, way, way back in time, you know, and so there is something about us that is wired aggressively. I mean, if you look at cultures that seem kind of peaceful, et cetera, like the Maoris in New Zealand, they destroyed all of the wild, 90% of the wildlife on that island, all of the large birds that used to exist in New Zealand on that island were basically wiped out within the course of a few hundred years. And places like Easter Island. So there is something kind of aggressive and rapacious that's embedded in us, that's wired into our nature. And the thing I wanted to study about warfare was not the violent side, but the intelligent, rational side, because I believe a lot of some of the highest elements in our civilization actually emerge from warfare, which is seems kind of paradoxical. But the ability to think strategically, which is something that I'm obsessed with, and is a sort of a theme in all of my books, the ability to step back from immediate circumstances and say, in order to win this battle, in order to get this result, I have to think differently. I have to plan ahead. I have to plan moves like on a chessboard. And that kind of thinking and that kind of controlling of immediate impulses in order to win a battle and to use things like ambushes and attacks from the flank, which are kind of classic warfare strategies, that requires a high level of rationality. So I wanted to talk about the roots of some of our highest levels of thinking and how they come from warfare itself.
You say that fear is one of the most powerful weapons of war. Tell me.
Well, you know, there was one of the great battles that I discussed in there is a battle in the 19th century between the Zulus of Africa in the 1870s and the British who were trying to, you know, get rid of them, get them off their land. And, you know, the British had all of these incredibly sophisticated weaponry and all this discipline. And the Zulus were basically tribal and they only had spears. And they ended up surrounding and completely annihilating the English army, one of the greatest upsets in military history. And it was the psychological aspect that they played on that was so brilliant, where they gave the impression that the opponents were completely surrounded and they had no hope and they were just going to basically suffocate them by moving closer and closer till they had no escape routes. And the psychological pressure was overwhelming. So psychology plays a major role in warfare. And Sun Tzu, the greatest, kind of one of the great brilliant strategists in warfare, said, "The highest form of the art of war is to win without any bloodshed. The enemy surrenders because they are so afraid, because you have broken them down from the inside before a single shot is fired that they basically give up." So the ability to intimidate and put fear in your enemy is a classic psychological strategy in all forms of warfare.
I think of the story of Vlad the Impaler, who would have his people, his troops, carry on the top of their swords and spears heads of their victims. And they'd march them through all the people, and they'd see this, and, well, they marched to the same tune. They stayed in line.
Yeah. Well, the story that I like, that I use a lot, is the story of Cortez and his conquest. Now, you may find it a rather horrifying story, but nevertheless, it's an insane victory that he accomplished when you have 500 men against hundreds of thousands of Aztecs.
Aztecs, yeah.
But basically what he did was, you know, they sailed from Cuba to the Yucatan coast of Mexico, and in like three or four ships, and he realized that his soldiers were kind of intimidated by the odds against them, and he was worried that they wouldn't have enough fighting spirit to overcome these incredible odds. So he secretly had one of his confidants go in and drill all of these holes in the boats and make them unseaworthy, and then have them burned when some of them didn't completely sink, and as if it was an accident. And all the soldiers now had to realize there was no going back to Cuba or Spain. It was either victory or death.
Jeez. You know?
And I call that the death ground strategy. And you find that in personally when you're facing a deadline and you have only like 1 week to get something done, whereas you thought you had a month. You're going to work like hell because you know if you don't, you're going to fail. And armies have always been doing that. They put their own soldiers in desperate situations to make them fight like hell. And so, you know, that's another element, using kind of fear as a motivating factor.
I'm sure Cortez did not put holes in his boat, though.
Yes, he did.
He did.
Yes, he did. Yes, there was no going back. And that was, you know, they had to realize that their whole future depended on their success there. And he stayed for quite a long time. I mean, he was the governor of Mexico for a while, and he married an indigenous woman. And, you know, and so, yeah, he stayed. All the boats were destroyed. There was no escaping even for him, because he felt, you know, if he thought he had an out, then he would. I mean, it's a great lesson in human energy and willpower. If you feel like you have an out in a situation, if you feel like you don't really have to do something, that there's no skin in the game, that if the consequences of losing aren't that bad, you're not going to try very hard. But if the stakes are high and you losing is going to be like your reputation is ruined or you're financially ruined, you're going to work 100 times harder than before when complacency will tend to set in.
And isn't it smart, though, in any kind of battle, warfare strategy to give somebody an out?
Well, sometimes it is. Yeah, give them a retreat route so that, you know, that they feel that makes them want to surrender. They feel like, you know, they have only one way out. You've got them surrounded, and they can escape this one route.
Let them save face.
Yeah, sometimes that is. And you know, you can go too far. I have a law in my first book called In Victory, Know When to Stop. So sometimes you can go too far in your victory and crushing the enemy, and you create an enemy that is vowed to destroy you. And some people think that the Treaty of Versailles after World War One, in which we gave the heaviest of penalties to Germany, was what kind of eventually sowed the seeds for Hitler's rise to power. And so we were very vengeful with the Treaty of Versailles. We wanted to make sure that Germany could never rearm. And we went too far in our victory, and we created the circumstance, the resentment that would eventually lead to something like Hitler.
Robert Green with us. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Let's go to some calls here for you, Robert, for the rest of this hour. Thomas in La Jolla, California gets us started. Hi, Tom.
Hi, George. Thank you. And Robert, just great information. I look forward to purchasing many of your books.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. A comment and then a question.
Yeah.
I dated a lady,
yeah,
and she was very attractive.
Yeah.
And I kept trying to figure it out, like, you know, and one day we were sitting in her living room, and I said to her, I said, you know, I finally figured it out. What perfume do you use?
Uh-huh.
Because you're very attractive. And she laughed and laughed and laughed. and she led me into her bathroom, and she showed me all of her soaps and shampoos. They were all non-scented, no scent, no perfume, etc. And she showed me her paper products, you know, tissue paper and everything, all non-scented. And she said, Thomas, she said, the reason why I smell great is you're not smelling perfume, you're smelling me.
Uh-huh.
And then she led me to her library. And in her library, she had all of these papers. She was an academic. And she had all these papers and books and public relations, monographs, and that type of thing on the role of scent, odor, smell, in, you know, between human beings. And I'm not talking virtual. I'm not talking Zoom.
No.
You know, I'm talking direct-to-direct interaction. And then she was showing me the history of smell, like going back into classical times. And the even the Bible, you know, always talks about the smell of people. And so I was wondering, it seems like smell, odor, scent, pheromones are under the radar, so to speak, yet they affect direct, not virtual, direct human interaction. And I was wondering if you would, it seems like you'd be the logical person to ask about this. So
I wrote a book, my second book, called The Art of Seduction, which is, I talk not just about sexual seductions, but social, political, and marketing seductions. But I definitely talk about men and women seducing each other. And I talk in there about how seduction is this weird kind of language that has nothing to do with words, that a lot of the communication happens through sense, through our senses. And smell is an extremely important one. And, you know, it's weird because early on, I've been married for a while. My wife would say that there was some scent that I had that she was really attracted to. And I wear no cologne or anything. You know, there was no conscious thing. But there's something women have where there's a certain kind of smell that they pick up on men that kind of makes them very excited. And obviously, we have the same with pheromones. And it's not just smells. It's also sounds. So I tell people in the realm of seduction, the sound of people's voice plays an incredible role. You know, you can be seduced just by hearing that voice on a telephone. I know certain female voices that I find immensely captivating, and I can't really resist even without seeing the face. So we're such a visual animal that in things like that, we think everything is about how we look, and we don't pay attention to all the other things that communicate, like scent and like sounds, etc., and touch, obviously. And, you know, we've become so virtual and so digital that we're losing touch with our kind of animal nature. And it's really weird. In the animal world, scent plays a huge role, not just in sex and mating rituals, but in also communication. You know, animals communicate a lot with the smells that they emit, and we're animals as well. And so this is a part of our nature that we have lost, I'm afraid.
Robert, as you apply the laws of human nature, where does social media fit in with all this?
Well, that's a great question, George. You know, I maintain that there's a very primitive part of ourselves that hasn't really changed in thousands and thousands of years. And people will say, well, I mean, look at the internet and technology. Certainly we've changed. And I say, actually, social media reveals the most primitive parts of our nature, you know, 10 times exponentially. And so, for instance, I talk a lot in my books about our propensities to envy and how chimpanzees are creatures that definitely show signs of envy, and that in hunter-gatherer societies, the fact that somebody might envy what you possess is the worst thing because you would probably kill them to get it. So they create all kinds of rituals to make sure that all gifts were shared. So envy has deep, deep roots in our nature. And you look at something like social media, Instagram or Facebook, and these are just machines for feeding our envy tendencies. When my friends are constantly posting photographs of their most wonderful vacations in Tahiti, etc., all I can feel is envy. You know, like I'm sitting here in my my you know, small little smelly house here in Los Angeles. I don't have as great a family or as great a job or as great a vacations as you do. So, yeah, I feel envy. And then all of our dark, aggressive impulses, you know, what we call trolling, people can get online and be as mean and nasty as they want and pay no consequences because nobody ever sees their face.
Yep.
And so you can air out all of your darkest impulses on the internet. So as opposed to being this highly sophisticated medium, I say it actually reveals some of the most primitive aspects of our nature.
It does. And so many people, they hide behind these avatars. You don't know who they are. And they're just mean-spirited people.
Yeah.
But they would never be that way in public.
No, God, no. And often if you ever meet them, they're like these timid, small people who are extremely nice and polite. But online, they can roar like a tiger, you know?
Let's go to Kelly in Eugene, Oregon. Welcome to the show. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. How are you, fellas?
Okay. Good to have you,
Kelly,
with us.
Thank you. Oh, I just wanted to say, when you were speaking about voices, I think you have an incredible soothing voice.
Oh, thank you.
Your guest. Yeah, it is. It's very calming.
Thank you, Kelly.
I do handwriting analysis.
Oh,
and
yeah.
When you were talking earlier, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And when you were talking earlier about the dark side of people, one of the first things I read before I like dove into it was that each person has three sides to them. And it is the way we see ourselves.
Yeah.
The way others see us. And the way we really are.
Uh-huh. That's very true. That's very true.
Can you
see in handwriting, can you see if somebody has, can you see their dark side or their kind of toxic? You can?
That's absolutely.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Really?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it changes all the time. Like people's handwriting, if you change your habits, your handwriting changes.
Uh-huh.
Like I found out a lot about me. When I did my, I was like, that don't sound like me. I just doubted everything. I had to call my daughter. I'm like, Chelsea, am I bossy? She went, yeah. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
So I kind of started paying attention to that a little bit more, not being so bossy, and my handwriting changed, and I'm not so bossy anymore.
I love it.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Thanks, Kelly. You know what they say, your reputation is what people see, Robert. Your character is what they don't see.
Well, I have a chapter in The Laws of Human Nature on character, and I completely agree with you. And the problem with humans is that we tend to judge everything based on appearances. So when we're looking to hire someone, we get caught up in their look and how they dress and how pleasant they are and their mannerisms and how nice their resume looks with all its experience and their degrees on it. And we're just looking at the surface, and we may hire them, and we discover to our chagrin, that they actually have a weak and bad character. And having someone with a good character is worth more than all of the degrees in the world. And so I judge character by strength and weakness.
So true.
A strong person can withstand stress and not crumble under it. They have, you know, what is known as presence of mind. Most important of all, a strong character can take criticism and not take it personally.
Hold on for a second, Robert. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll be back in a moment with Final Calls with Robert Greene as we talk about his incredible works and a fascinating discussion. It really is. His latest book is called The Laws of Human Nature. Next hour, Life After Breath with Jacob Cooper. We'll be talking about his near-death experience. So make sure you're part of the program. Welcome back. Robert Greene with us, The Laws of Human Nature, and we'll take your calls as well, final calls. Robert, what is it about the human nature where, for example, they will elect Joe Biden, and then months later, his popularity plummets? I mean, why do people change their minds so quickly?
Well, you know, sometimes you don't really know about a person until you elect them, just like I mentioned before. You hire somebody, and believe me, I do consulting for people in business, and the number one complaint is they hired somebody that they thought was competent and great, and then 6 months down the road, they discover that they're lazy or ambitious and only out for themselves, etc. And a president is somebody we hire, and we often can't look underneath the hood and really know deep down inside who they are. Now, you know, Biden has a history, and we kind of know that he's he's older, and there's nothing wrong with being older. You know, I'm getting older myself, but older people tend to get a little set in their ways. They have a little harder time adjusting. And so in the first couple months, you know, people were looking for someone who would kind of calm everything down. And, you know, we had a turbulent period under Trump, whether you loved him or hated him, and people were looking kind of for calmness. And then we're discovering that, you know, with things like Afghanistan, with things like inflation, with things like prices going up, that it's not as calm as we hoped.
No. And COVID-19 didn't help him either, did it?
Well, it did initially, but, you know, I mean, some of the mandates, I guess, have been proving unpopular. But, you know, it's hard to judge a president. It's a common theme in history where we think we've elected a person who's like this, and they end up being like something completely opposite from what we expected. It's common enough to say that, you know, that's going to be happening again in the future. And so we don't really know the character of the person that we're selecting to be our president.
Let's go back to the calls. First time caller, Michael in Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Michael.
Yes, sir. So grateful to be on the show. I'll just get right to it.
Sure.
I'd like to cite two examples of how and why human beings have been so successful as far as warfare is concerned.
Yeah.
One is that how we defeated the Neanderthal. You see, I've done a lot of cultural anthropology in the past, and I've discovered that sign language is a very difficult language to lie in, use all body language and so forth.
Yeah.
But human beings, their greatest achievement was the lie.
Yeah.
They were able to draw these people in and ambush them by convincing them that they were safe. Another example, there's a new conspiracy theory that the Ark of the Covenant was not actually a casket-shaped object, but a large wooden drum that was capable of producing a sound that sounded almost like thunder. It was used to keep the people of Moses moving through the desert in a certain direction. Well, when they got to Jericho, they got outside of arrow and spear range and just started pounding the poop out of this drum for 6 days in a row, causing sleep deprivation.
Oh, that's interesting, too. I guess where he's headed is strange things happen to manipulate the human mind, Robert.
Well, you know, they call us the Machiavellian animal, the Machiavellian primate. And, in fact, studies show that chimpanzees are probably also very Machiavellian. So, and they show that they're good at kind of hiding things and deceiving and using facial expressions to kind of put people off the scent, etc. So there's something about us and our ability to deceive that is very powerful, for better or for worse. And it's also one of the most common themes in the history of warfare. And the greatest strategists in the world, including in World War II, which our success depended on a massive campaign of deception leading to Operation Overlord and D-Day. You know, in warfare, deception is absolutely essential. As Winston Churchill said, truth is so precious that it must be guarded by a bodyguard of lies.
Let's go to Mike in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
George, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you.
And Robert, wow, thank you so much for this information this evening. Yeah. This has been so helpful, so thank you. And I just had a comment and a question. So, Robert, when we talk about developing traits, you know, I'm a younger person. I'm 25. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think that, for example, self-confidence, it's something that, like, a lot of younger people struggle with. And,
yeah.
You know, like, I'm always so, like, in awe of George because he is always so confident under pressure on the radio.
Yeah.
But Robert, I wanted to ask you about, for younger people, you know, what advice would you give for people going through their 20s on developing these really important traits like self-confidence? And, you know, what were some things you learned about yourself in your earlier years in your 20s that you would kind of pass on to current generations?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I wrote a book sort of on that subject. It's my fifth book called Mastery. And I say that you have to have a sense of what you were meant to accomplish in life, what your destiny is. You were born as a unique individual. Your DNA will never be repeated in the history of the universe and has never occurred before. There's something about you that makes you different, and that is your source of power in life. And so if you're able to fall into a career that you are, that kind of connects to who you are, to what I call your primal inclinations, then developing confidence is not so difficult. But the thing is, I tell people that the key to having confidence is in your achievements, in what you can do in your skill levels. So if you develop skills in something, and these skills are very real, and you've developed them over the course of 5 or 10 years, the proverbial 10,000 hours, it's very, very easy to feel confident. You have some, you have a foundation that you can rely upon. But if your confidence is not based on anything real, that's not really confidence, that's grandiosity. And the first time you experience any kind of failure or setback, that confidence will just kind of melt. It will dissolve at the first sort of obstacle. So to have real confidence, you have to build up some true level of skill and to have some accomplishments and some achievements in your life. And that doesn't come overnight. You have to be patient, but you have to understand that it comes through your work more than anything else, that confidence. And you asked about me personally. I have to be honest. I didn't have success in my life until I was about 38, 39 years old, and that's quite late when I got my first book out there. And up until then, I kind of wandered around at many, many different jobs, and I had a very up-and-down career, and there would be moments of massive depression where I just felt, what am I doing? Where is my life headed? But deep down inside, I had this kind of bedrock faith where I couldn't sink lower, and that faith was, I knew I was meant to be a writer. I knew that I had developed skill. I had worked as a journalist. I had worked in Hollywood. I knew how to write. I had discipline. And at some point, it's going to come together. And so that kind of saw me through all the darkest days that I passed through. So the true confidence comes through your work, through your ability to kind of master certain skills, and to have something that you can always rely on in life. If you're good at what you do, nobody can ever take that away from you. And I counsel people to develop those skills or that kind of confidence on a day-by-day basis. It doesn't come overnight. You need to do baby steps and need to be kind of figuring out what it was you were meant to accomplish in this world and having discipline and persistence in that.
Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Robert. You're covering several topics, but I do have a couple of things I want to bring up. One would
sure.
be on the psychology. One thing I notice is people think they're sidestepping behavior when they're not completely doing that. Say, you know, I'm driving 90, someone goes past me 150, I think I'm a cautious driver where I'm not. Another example with the psychologist, I think people see something like the corporate thing, you know, it's on a hierarchy, and then they globalize to think everything's on a hierarchy that they're trying to achieve, and it's not on a ladder necessarily. And then with, you know, you mentioned people getting stale on social skills, but I think sometimes then you misjudge people. I remember walking with kind of a model to walk into the subway, and she seemed a little stale, but I realized that she was sitting in her, you know, she had just come from her office job and was sitting in a corner all day. And also, I wanted to just ask you what you thought about Truman not allowing MacArthur to have his 9 nuclear bombs to bomb China. What'd you think about that?
Well, you know, I haven't really delved deeply into that subject, but I know that Truman and MacArthur had a lot of friction.
Yes.
And that MacArthur, you could love him or hate him, and he was a brilliant general, and his campaign in the Philippines is a model that people always return to. It was a brilliant. But he had a bit of megalomania. He is what I would call a grandiose figure, and in Laws of Human Nature, I discuss grandiosity. And what I mean by that is, sometimes success is the worst thing that can happen to a human being. You start overestimating your skill level. You don't realize the level of luck in your success. And so he was a brilliant general, don't get me wrong, but he got a little bit in love with his own,
It went to his head.
It went to his head completely. And he was almost almost a little bit imbalanced, and he showed that when he came back to the United States a little bit, and he had his brief run at becoming president, etc., as opposed to an Eisenhower, who I think is a much underrated president and who was a brilliant general. And the story of Eisenhower is absolutely amazing because people were completely always underestimating him. They thought he was boring, dull, not a very good strategist, where in fact he was a brilliant strategist. He was groomed by Marshall in the Defense Department. And Eisenhower had a very even keel, and he understood the role of success and the danger of that kind of megalomania, which even like a Patton succumbed to, although Patton, I think...
Patton a lot of rope, didn't he?
Yes, he did, because Patton was an absolutely fantastic general. On a strategic level, he was probably superior to Eisenhower, and he recognized that, which was what was great about Eisenhower, was that he didn't have much of an ego, and he could recognize that some people were really good, and you had to manage their personalities and let them fight. But Patton was a bit in the MacArthur mold where he could get it become a little bit dangerous.
I always told myself that in any business I was in or anything I've done, surround yourself with the best people you can find.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, that's the wisest thing. And that's what I tell the story in my war book about Marshall when he was given the realm, the head of the Defense Department, which was absolutely in tatters. And Roosevelt recognized that a war was coming and that he could not fight this war with the Defense Department being in such a mess. There were all these people who had had these positions for 20, 30 years and they weren't doing anything. And Marshall came in and completely cleaned it up, and he did it by hiring all of the best people, his lieutenants, who would go out and do what he wanted, people like Eisenhower, people like Bradley. So hiring the best people, that's what really makes a great leader.
Absolutely. Cornelius is with us in Louisiana. Hello there, Cornelius.
Hey there, George and Robert. How y'all doing there?
Hi, Cornelius.
Look, George knows me and stuff, and Tommy, I ran into some racist stuff. I'm an African-American, and I love the show and everything. And, George, every time you get a good guest on, I heard them clip Catherine Austin Fitz. So I tell you. Every time. But do you deal with anything with racism, Mr. Robert? And I'll take my answer off the air. God bless you, George.
Okay, Corny.
I have a lot of African-American characters in my books. I always try to make sure that my books are not just about white men. And so
And you've had a lot of musicians who are African-American read your books.
Yes, yes. I'm very popular in the hip-hop world, and I wrote a book with the rapper 50 Cent called The 50th Law, and I've worked with Drake before. I tell the story, for example, of Frederick Douglass, whom I admire an awful lot, and his autobiography should be read by everybody in this country. He's one of our true icons. And then in my last book, The Laws of Human Nature, I go very deeply into the story of Martin Luther King. And I show King as a human being because a lot of the great figures in our history, they tend to become sort of these cartoon figures. And in fact, Martin Luther King was extremely human. He had weaknesses, and he understood them. And he was a very humble man in a way. And I love his story. I use it to demonstrate the importance of having a calling in life, of having a sense of purpose. And he didn't have that sense of purpose as a young man, and then he discovered it late in life. So I don't address particularly racism, although my book, 48 Laws of Power, is extremely popular among African-American readers. But it's kind of a sub-theme because I talk about how you form real power in this world and the need to be strategic and not just be angry and venting yourself and getting in love with your words, but how true change is accomplished in this world.
Absolutely. Robert, I want to thank you for being on the program. The clock has got us, but love to get you back.